Our second speaker is Hannah Hamdi, and she is on the research faculty at the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Department of Family Medicine. Dr. Hamdi holds a joint PhD in urban systems with an emphasis in public health and urban architecture from UMDNJ, Rutgers University, and School of Architecture at the New Jersey Institute of Technology. Her research focuses on the impact of the built and social environments on health, and more specifically, she's interested in the causes and consequences of diet-related illness among families living in low-income neighborhoods. So, Dr. Hamdi.
I have no conflict of interest to disclose. This data or research that I'm presenting was actually my dissertation. I just defended in June. I feel really good to say that. I never thought it would end. So the purpose of my dissertation, the big dissertation, and I'm only going to present a segment of it today, was to identify and document factors that comprise neighborhood food environments. We have defined food environments in so many ways, but in the neighborhoods that I was interested, I wanted to be able to define it in a way that was very sensitive to the residents. The second part was that was to gauge how these factors that I've identified actually shape acquisition, food acquisition practices of the residents. I had two objectives. The first one was to systematically characterize neighborhood food environments of the three neighborhoods in Newark South Ward where I conducted my dissertation. And the second one, more relevant to this presentation, is to document the factors that influence residents' food acquisition practices in their own voice. Not something that I've identified, but I went to the community and asked, so what are the issues that actually impact how you go about shopping for food and what you eat and where do you shop? This is the conceptual framework that guided my study, and I defined food environment in a very broad and very narrow aspect. So I have the community environment, the consumer environment, and then the household environment, all which determines how the participants participate in the food environment. This was my entire dissertation. It was multi-stranded. The first phase included characterizing the neighborhood at large. So I looked at the social demographics, the physical characteristics, neighborhood wealth of each neighborhood in the South Ward. I identified, enumerated all the food service venues, all 91 grocery stores, and they're defined in different categories. So I have convenience stores, bodegas, and the way that I'm defining bodegas is very social in the way that it means that the existing supermarkets, whether they're 200 square feet or they hold nine or two cashiers, is that they have sustainable longevity in the community and they actually provide services that the families in of need need. The third part that I looked is at segregation. I looked at segregation in terms of structural. So I looked at racial, social, and cultural. And then the third thing that came up is crime. And I used the 2010 crime, and I obtained that from the local police office department. And I used GIS to spatially approximate the distribution of all the food venues in relationship to where the crimes happen, and also dissimilarity, the index of dissimilarity. And then we created a buffer zone, how many, the space in which the participants walk. Initially, I looked at the data, we conducted lit review, and the average is about a mile, half a mile. But we actually found out that for the participants, particularly the elderly, it was less than a quarter of a mile. So the part that I'm going to focus on today is actually this section, the qualitative component, which was very important in how it guided the other parts of my study. Although it was stranded in its multi-phasing, the focus groups informed how I go back and retool my instrument, the qualitative instrument. So this is Newark. It has five wards, and I worked in the South Ward. Actually, there are four neighborhoods, but the fourth neighborhood was very similar to Week Way, so I kind of merged those two together, so I looked at three neighborhoods. This is the demographics for all of Newark. I'm going to give you a minute or two to look at it. So initially when I started the research as a doctoral student, I was told, well, you know what, the South Ward is predominantly African American. All the people that live in the South Ward are poor, and they all participate in the same food environment in the same way. So I wanted to go do my own research and found something that was very different. Week Way is one of the oldest neighborhoods in Newark. It was historically Jewish, and after the 1960s riots, when many of, you know, the white Jews and middle-class African-Americans moved into the suburbs. I looked at the zoning designation of each neighborhood as an architect or urban designer. We're asked to do these things. And it was very important because what it did for me is laid out how the food venues were distributed. So in lower Clinton Hills, was the most impoverished neighborhood of all three, is classified as industrial mixed use. So what types of food venues, even within the narrowly described grocery stores, the least offering grocery stores were found in that strip. So lower Clinton Hills, Upper Clinton Hills, and Week Way. Week Way is completely residential. Upper Clinton Hill is mixed light and residential at the time that I was conducting the study. I actually started collecting data my first year. My instruments were developed during my first year project, and each year it fed into my dissertation. By the fourth year, I had completed all my instruments. But as I said, the focus group heavily influenced what I was collecting. So it wasn't so much that the qualitative dictated, you know, what I found, it was what the residents, because we wanted to look at how do these neighborhoods, these residents, actually access food. We don't have a way, right? So they told us. So this is the demographics of all of the South Ward. So the method that I used for the qualitative component, because I wanted to look at how each residents within these three neighborhoods access food, so it was purposive sampling, but I had to be very strategic. So I utilized the assets and needs of each neighborhood. For Week Way, many of the residents are affluent. They weren't really interested in the $15 that I was giving or the free dinners that I was offering. So I went to the local churches and begged the pastors and the bishops to actually ask some of the residents to participate in my study. As you will see, the demographics of the participants vary because of how I approached the resident or the participants. For Lower Clinton Hills, I specifically went and targeted my participants at the end of the month. That's when many of the families do not have food and do not have access to cash. So the largest participants of my study came from that area. My interest is to look at how low-income families participate. So it would have been nice to have, you know, more from the residents of Week Way and even Upper Clinton Hill. But the interest of my dissertation was that of the Lower Clinton Hill family. So we send out flyers. I was very fortunate in that the local municipal officers were very helpful. So they send out emails asking for participants to recruit. And I went out to churches, I went out to rallies, I went to funerals, I went to marriages, everything so that, you know, I can talk about this study that's coming in the future. It was a year or two. Meantime, I was working on the IRB consent. So the eligibility was very basic, that you would have to live in Newark in the South Ward for more than 1 year, and you had to be older than 18. And most of them were. And the data generation, I used grounded theory for both data generation and data analysis. And something else I wanted to mention. Reliability. We used percent agreement, and in all the emergent themes, it was very high. It was more than 86 for each item, for each thing that emerged. This is the characteristics of my participant. So we conducted 12 focus groups and 2 focus groups beforehand, which actually helped to develop the instrument guide, and for a total of 108 participants total. And then after the focus groups were conducted, I drew on two more focus groups for member checking to make sure that the themes that arise were actually within what they defined to be the issues that help either facilitate how they access food or hinder how they access food. There's also, so we looked at the simple demographics, and I also implemented a two-item literacy scale looking at food label readability and serving measures. So the findings vary. Lower Clinton Hill had, on average, the lowest of everything. Income. Access to private transportation, cars. Most of the people that owned the cars were the elderly above 60 and over. Home ownership was the least, 12%. And even some of those who said they owned homes didn't actually belong to them. It belonged to an aunt, an uncle, or a grandmother. Health literacy was low. And even more so for Upper Clinton Hill. It was moderate for Weequay. The highest education were for participants from Weequay. And so when I said how I targeted the participants really reflected the demographics. So the number of male participants in my study were very low. There's this trust issue still. I've been in the South Ward for 5 years, that people still are not comfortable, you know, with participating in. But the men that participated in this study were very helpful in understanding that, you know, there's a segment of the residents that we don't even talk about, how black men actually participate in the food system. We don't look at how they negotiate health. We don't look at what they eat. So this was an eye-opener for us, particularly at the department, because we, in family medicine, we talk about family, but we completely neglect the health of black men. So this is the beginning of our research. So some of these selected findings. So there's a taste of luxury versus taste of necessity. Families in Weequay had a complete different definition of how, you know, about food choice. How do, you know, so when we ask, you know, how do you choose your food? Where do you shop? Why do you shop? How often do you shop? So for many of the families in Weequay, it was very important for them to travel, to spend a lot of money, and to do whatever they can to access food that's beneficial to their health. They wanted food that was organic, food that was slow cooked, things that, you know, they could access, and things they didn't mind driving an hour and a half to South Jersey to access fresh produce. They didn't mind paying over $500 a week for CSA to be delivered to their homes. And it was a different story in Lower Clinton Hill. Many of the families that we asked, well, how do you, where do you shop, how often do you shop, and how do you get there, told us a different story that you wouldn't even think that people actually live in close proximity. Many of the parents were struggling. Many of the parents had no social support or safety net. When they deplete their income at the end of the month, they resort to very strategic ways of coping. So many of the themes that arise between the participants in Lower Clinton Hill were those of survival, were those of making ends meet, were those of, you know, nothing that pertained to health. It was all about just meeting, you know, sort of eating. I have to feed my child. I have to feed my grandchildren. So if you look at these statements, and I'll give you a second or two, they're very contrast. So we had to go back and see if we can find something in the middle, right? It can't be that drastic. So many of the families talked about not eating two or three nights a week at the end of the month. In health, we don't talk about hunger. We talk about food insecurity. But clearly, these families talked about hunger. This is one of the same participant in Lower Clinton Hill, and this is how she actually makes ends meet. When families receive, whether it's WIC or SNAP, they cash it in the local grocery stores or corner markets. The corner markets cash their SNAP or WIC for a dollar to a 50 cent on end. when they do this, they lose about 50 cents on a dollar. But that 50 cents go a long way to meet their rent, transportation, or things that they can't buy. Toiletries. You can't buy toiletries with SNAP or WIC, but these are necessary things. You can't buy gas with WIC money. You can't buy gas with SNAP. But these are the, so when they're transferring this cash, a dollar on 50 cents, clearly they're losing, but they've learned how to stretch that 50 cent, well, I'm sorry, the $1.50 rather than those $2. So many of the families, particularly the mothers in Laura Clinton Hill, they spoke to them and they said, well, how do you choose to eat healthy? There is no option to eat healthy. And many of them looked at me when it blanked there, well, what are you talking about? What would you do if you were in our position? How would you go about finding healthy food in the dog ward? As a vegetarian, when I first came to Newark, I struggled. There wasn't anywhere that I can do, particularly where I'm situated. It's not even in the South Ward, in the Center Ward. And we have this corner that we call the Cancer Corner. It's nothing but tobacco stores, fried chicken, pizzas, and Chinese food restaurants that are not even healthy. So what in the first arm of my dissertation, when we characterized the neighborhood food environment, we actually used the NEMS survey. You get familiar with that. It was developed by Glantz et al. For both restaurants and the grocery stores. We went in to evaluate what types of food are available. And initially, we wanted to look at the differences in price between healthy and standard option food. And we're quickly surprised to find that, you know, the cost of healthy foods was consistent. There were no changes in prices for 1 year. And they're consistently high. So a gallon of low-fat milk was consistently at $6 something. Well, we saw fluctuation in prices, you know, in regular gallons. Another thing that came up that affected how participants actually negotiate their food environment was violence. We don't talk about violence when we talk about access to, you know, to have food, right? But in Newark, where homicide is the second leading cause, we need to talk about violence. And what we found from the focus group interview that there are two types of violence. Targeted crimes, and then these rampant drug-related, gang-related crimes. But I don't, although they are different, I don't see them differently. They have the same impact on the community. So for the elderly, it's the targeted crime that affects them the most. And they become target at the beginning of the month when they receive their checks, SSIs. So they get robbed, or their groceries become, you know, so they hijack their cars and their groceries. For young men, what we found is that, you know, these drug-related, gang-related crimes happen. When we did the spatial analysis to find how close the crime and non-fatal crimes actually happen to food venues, they're less than a quarter of a mile. So many families reported that at the times where we saw spikes of crime incidents, and that's at 3 o'clock, or during summer months, or during the holidays, families refused to let their kids go outside and shop. As one of the participants mentioned, his nephew had died the year before, so the parents are traumatized. The kids can't go out to the corner store and pick up anything. So they feel that they have to protect their kids. There's constant, you know, anxiety or angst attached to going outside. Many of the elderly felt that they were confined and isolated to home because they don't feel safe to walk, not just because they're targeted, but they don't know when these crimes happen. There was one of the things that we found was structural and social isolation. It actually arises out of the similarity index that we calculated for the three neighborhoods. In terms of racial isolation, the South Ward is one of the most segregated wards in Newark. It's at the time that I started collecting the data, I can go back and actually show you. If you look look at the percent of African Americans per neighborhood, when I first started collecting this data, it was for Lower Clinton Hill and Upper Clinton Hill, it was up in 90. Between 2008 and 2010, there's been a lot of mobility. Many people lost their homes, so many people were coming in from different neighborhoods. So now the demographic is consistent of African Americans and Latinos, and some residents of Arab descent. So when the families were talking about, you know, where they access food, it's not that there aren't farmers markets in Newark as a whole. There are. During the time that I was collecting the data, actually there were 14 farmers markets throughout Newark, and they're accessible through public transportation. They just think, well, that's where I go shop. Why aren't you shopping there? They paused, and they were like, well, we can. So they spoke to, you know, so A, it's hard to shop on the bus, right? You can get there, but coming back with fruits and vegetables is difficult, particularly for the elderly and disabled, people with disabilities that we interviewed. Then there was the social isolation, or the flip side of cultural capital. Like, many of the people that owned the farmers markets were not from Newark. They were not even of African descent. And if they were African descent, they were either Afro-Caribbean or immigrants from Africa. So many of the residents who were native African Americans did not feel that they were welcomed in the stores. Many people said that, A, they don't carry the food that's relative to their own diet. And if they do go there, they're not welcomed. They felt that they were begging. And they're often chased or followed. And made that, you know what, there isn't space for you here. So when they don't venture outside of this South Ward, it's because of issues we never consider for food access. The takeaway message from here is that neighborhood food environments are neighborhood by neighborhood phenomena. Not two neighborhoods are alike. So when we're looking to design interventions for food access, we need to look at how food environments vary. And there are more than the absence or presence of food venues. There are issues that, you know, facilitate or, you know, present as barriers to access. And that food acquisitions and behaviors are nuanced experiences that are shaped by physical characteristics. For example, the structural composition of space, such as transportation or zoning. And then also the community at large that mediates venues that are available, but also the social capital, the social cultural issues that we don't talk about, violence. We cannot define or understand neighborhood food environments if we don't involve the residents. When I was collecting the data, I trained about six residents, two from each neighborhood, to help us design the instrument. More than helping us to develop this research is that, you know, we're able to employ some of the residents, and they became our permanent partners in this. And someone as an outsider from Newark, I could see something that, you know, that's told to me by a resident, and I can misunderstand it, right? There's that remove legitimacy, how we understand the subject. But having the resident actually as co-researchers help facilitate our understanding. And that's it. Thank you so much. I actually thought the 37 was high, so we went back into the focus groups and then we saw, and we looked at the demographic data and said, well, are you really employed and how much of your time? So they're employed part-time. So the unemployment is very high, we just don't know how high because it's not documented. But what we're able to find is that, you know, that 37% of them had part-time jobs. But then And if you look at how many of them are on social services, I mean, they receive social service assistance. It's pretty much accurate. So one of the things that we're able to do is I was very fortunate to receive a grant for an intervention based on preliminary findings of this dissertation. And so part of that funding went into developing a community farm. So we have a farm that's owned by Newark Preschool. And I'm working with the family, the local farmer, and a local grocer to help actually teach the families how to grow their own fresh produce. And sell it to the local, you know, supermarket. But that's not sustainable, and I don't think that's what you're asking, right? So in order for us to have sustainable or lasting impression on the community, I think we need to change the fundamental needs and best, you know, the poverty level. So education needs to be a key in how we address this. Employment is an issue. One of the reasons that we employ people from the community is that, you know, they become owners of that data. They become employed. They have a skill that we can leave behind. I could do my dissertation. I didn't have to go back to Newark, right? But once I leave, if someone else leaves, we need to leave something that's sustainable. Knowledge is something no one can take away, anybody. So educating the community is one step. Community gardens are cute. they build social cohesion. What we need is on local farms that's owned by the community. Less than 1% of the 91 corner stores there that I surveyed are owned by Newark residents. Even less are owned by African Americans living in the South Ward. And the South Ward is one of the oldest African American communities. So we brought in, so my pilot focus group was actually how to develop this instrument. How do I reach out to Newark or the South Ward residents? So when I said food acquisition practices, people looking like, what? So I was like, well, I want to understand where you shop. And when you shop, how often do you shop? What stops you from shopping for healthy food? Some people need a definition of what healthy meant. One of the earliest focus groups I interviewed residents, but intergenerational to see if there's any differences. And I interviewed grandmothers, mothers, and young women under 18. So the younger women, I was asking, how often do you eat fruits and vegetables? She said, every day. I was like, really? I was like, well, where do you live? She said, here in the South Fork. I was like, well, what do you eat? I said, she eats kiwi. She eats mango. She eats bananas. I was like, I want to know where you shop. And so I can tell the rest. So she was like, well, you know, you can get it anywhere. I was like, well, do you eat vegetables? She said, yes, I eat vegetables every day. I was like, what kind of vegetables do you eat? I was really impressed. I mean, she eats broccoli and she eats peas. So I was like, where are you finding this? So her strawberries and kiwi come from Snapple. To this day, I still get goosebumps. So there's literacy that needs to happen, right? We need to define what healthy food means. When we say healthy, there are some kids who have never made it outside of the South Ward, right? So health literacy was important. I didn't find my health literacy instrument to be that particularly strong, so we're going to go back and modify it. But one of the things that we're looking at is, like, so you can change the environment, but then what happens when you build corner, you know, when you bring in sustainable farms? Do the families actually use the farm? And when they do use it, you know, how do you make sure that they go home and eat it in a way that's healthy, right? So all these things play together. So even when families, they know how to access, what she was saying is that she liked the idea that we pointed out some of the structural and cultural isolation factors, right? So the families know how to access fresh produce. They know Newark. They lived in Newark for most of their lives. But there are issues that prevent them from accessing. If it's not economic, if it's not structural, the cultural issues are real. We don't take that in consideration. I remember when I first came to Newark, and one of the supermarkets asked me to put my bag at the door. They're like, "Are you crazy?" I'm like, "I'm not leaving. I don't trust you. Why should I trust you if you don't trust me?" But I can do that, right? I have that empower, sort of disposition to say, "I'm not going to let you do this." But many of the families don't have that power. So they would follow whatever is there. So after the dissertation, I had time to reflect on this. So why do corner stores congregate in low-income communities, right? So there is this staple, money that comes in every month. So they look at WIC recipients, SNAP recipients, SSI. They target that. Where the large supermarkets can make money outside, sort of in the suburbs where there's transportation, they can buy land, or rent land for much cheaper. So one of the things that, that's also part of the study is we looked at the demographics of the stores. Who are these store owners? How much are they paying for rent? How much are they paying for tax? The net worth at the end of the year. Some of the corner stores make up to $70,000. And they own multiple corner stores, even though there may be one, but they own the average is about five for one, for the corner stores that are 2,500 square feet or more. So yes, they operate as small businesses, but they have a white rate. So my answer, and I struggle with this, it's not so much bringing in these large supermarkets because they tend to decay in quality. When I surveyed the corner stores versus the only available large chain supermarket is right on the outside, on the boundary of the South Ward, so many of the residents use it. So it's a national, supermarket, but the quality of that supermarket in Newark and then in my township, it's night and day. What I pay for at the weekend, on weekends when the quality has started to, deteriorate, is about the same that they buy it for fresh that first day when it arrives on a Thursday. So whatever doesn't sell in my township, gets shipped to Newark. So the answer isn't so much these large supermarkets, it's actually, empowering the community to have an ownership of these stores. So one of the things that Mayor Cory Booker is doing is developing local business owners through this nonprofit organization that he has. He's working with local supermarkets that have been, not corner stores, that have been in the community for more than 5 years. So in the first phase of my study, what I found is that the average life of a corner store is about 8 months. Stores come in, they do business for 8 months, and then they leave. Right? So what he's doing is encouraging corner stores to stay in the community for a long time. So he's giving tax incentives or tax abatements. And through NJIT, where I teach, we're having local architects who help some of the corner stores that own the land redesign or reappropriate the space to hold more refrigerators or freezers for fresh fruit, or the frozen food for fresh produce. Did that help your question?
Thank you. I want to thank both of our presenters, Dr. Hamdi and Dr. Hattori. Give them both a round of applause.